Welcome to Theory of Creativity, where we discuss the tools, techniques, and ideas for growing arts, culture, and creativity in our world. My name is Tandy Palmer-Williams, and I'm founder and managing director of a research agency called Pattern Makers. In this series, I join with colleagues from theatre, dance, music, visual arts, literature, and heritage to speak with experts in research, business, economics, technology, and policy. We talk about the challenges facing arts and cultural organisations today, like engaging audiences, securing funding, and creating positive impacts through our work. I want to help grow your organisation bigger, better, and stronger so that collectively we can do even more good in the world. In today's episode, I speak with Andrew McIntyre from Maurice Hargreaves McIntyre, or MHM, who are the creators of Culture Segments, a product which helps cultural organisations segment their audiences according to their mindset. In the arts, we often talk about audiences by age group or look at generational differences in the consumption of culture. But psychographic segments offer something much deeper, I think, and it's incredibly powerful to understand how someone's value system shapes their engagement patterns and the type of messaging they are receptive to. Stick around after the interview for my top takeaways from the discussion with Andrew, and I'm also going to do a new little segment which I'd love to get your feedback on. Today's episode is part of a new season of Theory of Creativity supported by Creative Victoria, centered around the idea of real change and renewal. We're exploring the tools, techniques, and ideas we can harness to build a newly thriving arts and culture sector post-pandemic and even herald in the next renaissance. Now, without further ado, here's my interview with Andrew McIntyre. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Lovely to be here. Nice to speak to you again.
So, Andrew, we first connected in, I'd say, 2014 or 2015 through the Digital R&D Fund for the Arts in England. And I was research manager for the fund, and you were leading one of the funded projects. And I think of the 50 or 60 projects funded, it was one of my favourites because it wasn't about, you know, some sort of sexy new immersive digital technology. It was simply about sharing audience data among organizations and establishing a data warehouse that enabled cross-marketing whilst upholding kind of privacy legislation. And if that's not a nut worth cracking, I don't know what is. So well done for that project.
Well, it's funny because that's one of my favorite projects too. And the nice thing about that, all those kind of funded projects that last for a year or so, it must be one of the only ones that's still going and thriving. So 5 or 6 years later, that database is alive and well in Newcastle Gates in the northeast of England, and is driving lots and lots of people to museums and arts things.
It's such a fabulous project. We could go down a bit of a tangent here, but what I'll do is pop a link in the show notes. If anyone wants to find out about this amazing project, I will pop a link into an article where you can read more about it and get in touch with Andrew. But anyway, we're actually here today because the pandemic is here, isn't it? And you wrote a series of articles last year, which I picked up on, very interesting, called Culture in Lockdown. And I want our listeners to hear about some of the ideas in the series and to learn more about your work. I think you're probably best known in the sector for being one of the M's in MHM, Maurice Hargreaves McIntyre, which is one of kind of the world's, you know, biggest and best consultancies specializing in the culture sector. I think we're very, very lucky to have an organization like yours working in the sector. But let's just hear a little bit about you and your background and how you came to kind of the helm of the ship MHM.
Oh, completely accidentally. I'd worked in kind of politics and campaigning originally, you know, that was my background. And I went and did a degree in politics and history and saw this job working for what was then called the National Museum of Labour History, which is now a much sexier title. It's now called the People's History Museum, and I did have a hand in that. And I was interested in it because of the politics and history, not because it was a museum. And I went and worked there for a little while, and in fact helped open it, and really quickly realised that people were wandering in, wandering round and wandering out. And the level of engagement was like nothing. It was a rock bottom. Yet in the exit survey, we had 95% satisfaction. And what I realized in the end was that was just a function of low expectation. people were entirely satisfied with the unengaging experience they just had. So I set about trying to understand how you engage people in museums, and then discovered that no one else was really doing that study, and that other museums I went to see how they were doing it were worse than us. And so then began a kind of fascination, and I do mean almost obsessive fascination, with what makes visitors tick, why people visit, why they don't, what they do when they get there, what's going on inside their heads. And once you've worked at the museum for a year, you're now the museum guy. And so that got me a job in Manchester, a city art gallery, where I kind of did the same thing and looked at how to reach parts of the population that we weren't reaching. And once you've worked at the museum and the gallery, you're then arts guy. That's it. And so I got a job at a kind of arts council funded startup, which was called Arts About Manchester, which was one of the first audience development agencies in the UK. And I was head of research there, or kind of built a research wing then, was head of research for about 8 years. And that was when no one was really doing research into arts audiences, like no one. So we kind of learnt as we went. And then, as always, Arts Council money always runs out, doesn't it? So we had a good run. And then we decided that we had a lot of people liked what we were doing. So I took my team and merged with the other M and the other H, Jerry Morris and Joanna Hargreaves, to form MHM. We were kind of collaborating anyway, and set up as a kind of independent agency, and never look back, really. So we started with three of us, and then we've kind of ended up with, I don't know, 40 of us or something, doing it on in lots of places, US and New Zealand and Australia and UK. For most of my working career, it's been an obsessive, compulsive interest in how to engage audiences in culture, and how to engage cultural organisations with audiences.
I love that you've come from actually doing it, and now advising people on kind of how to do it. And sounds like a wonderful career to me. And I think, I don't know if you're anything like me, but the questions that we face in the culture sector aren't easy. You know, they're kind of, there's lots of different demands on cultural organisations in terms of, you know, looking after a collection or making art. There's, you know, how to survive financially and thinking about commercial imperatives. And then there's, you know, doing the right thing and having a social purpose and being a good citizen and all of the fun and games that come with that. So I think it's, I can see why it's held your interest for so long. And yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you today and unpick some of the insights that you've learned over the years and yeah, let our audience hear a little bit about some of what you've learned over that time. So thank you again for coming along.
Can I also just say, just thinking as you were saying that I said at the beginning my initial interest was in kind of politics. And I think what I've come to realize is that culture and cultural policy and the way that cultural organizations act and behave and the role they play in society is fundamentally political. It's a political act. It's about cultural access and social justice, effectively. And we haven't got any money. We're facing all of these complicated challenges, even before COVID. But there's something about being in the room, or even being on Zoom with all of these people. If you put the staff of any of these organizations in a room, you just got the most astonishing, incredible group of highly intelligent, incredibly creative, utterly committed people.
Mm-hmm. Huge integrity.
Yeah. Right. So if you approach that conversation about how we're going to improve what we do with any kind of honesty, you're going to come out with a fantastic outcome, because you've got everything you need there in the room to create greatness.
Do you know what? I think you're absolutely right. And it's amazing, isn't it, to the number of times I've literally been in tears coming out of a workshop or a focus group, particularly where we've got members of the community or artists or people who've benefited from cultural programs in the room along with the people that deliver them. It's incredibly moving, isn't it? It's just absolutely astonishing.
You hope for that every time you go in to that room, and most of the time you're not disappointed. If I was going to design my perfect job, this would be it.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. It's a privilege, isn't it? All right. Well, look, the reason that I'm excited about this interview is because of one particular strand of your work at MHM, and that's culture segments. So culture segments, I'm sure many people listening will be familiar with it, but if you aren't super familiar with it already, I encourage you to go to mhminsight.com/culture-segments and really explore this tool, because it's probably the best kind of segmentation tool we have in the culture sector. There's plenty to explore on the MHM website, and you can even, you know, follow a link to find out which segment you are and play around with the tool. But Andrew, culture segments, as I understand them anyway, I would love you to tell us more about them, but they're psychographic segments, aren't they, Andrew? Can you tell us about what segmentation is and how culture segments has been developed?
In the old days, one size fitted all, or in fact, that wasn't true. We only offered one size, and it fitted the people who fitted it, and that was it, and nobody else engaged. But the realization that there are different audiences and we need to understand who they are and how to engage with them is kind of fundamental. And I think the idea of segments is not just to classify people, to, you know, categorize them in some way, but actually to identify groups of people who have enough in common with each other to make it worth addressing them separately, because they share some kind of need or they share some kind of mindset and therefore will respond in a particular way. And they're sufficiently different from another group of people who think or act in another different way that it makes it worthwhile to take the extra time or effort to differentiate our programming, our communications, our services between them. Because if we didn't do that, we would get fewer people engaging less deeply. Segmentation, though, can be inefficient. So we can fall into the trap of just categorizing people and then making assumptions about them. So we say, right, well, there are young people, and then there are families, and then there are so on. Because the easiest way to segment is demographic. You know, we can see the white, you know, rows full of people with white hair. We could see people with pushing buggies with children in. We can hear people with German accents, and we can say, yeah, they're the tourists and they're the families and whatever. But the problem we have is that your date of birth isn't a very good guide to your cultural engagement. I think Donald Trump and Mick Jagger almost share a birthday, but I don't see them out at contemporary dance together. So, you know, you are, and same with young people. All people under the age of 25 aren't all interested in the same art, and for the same reason. So, whilst it's interesting, and there may be some value to monitoring demographics, it doesn't in the end tell you anything. It doesn't really tell you why people engage. It doesn't tell you how they'll engage. It doesn't tell you what they'll respond to. So, psychographics, instead of looking at people's, you know, postcode or their date of birth, we're actually trying to understand what's going on inside their heads, their deep-seated values and their deep-seated cultural beliefs. And really, we're trying to understand what role people perceive culture will play in their life. And if we understand what needs they're trying to meet with culture, then we can better match our offer to those needs, but we can also better communicate the way in which our cultural offer can engage and meet those needs. And I think that's seems really obvious saying that, but when we set up culture segments, there was nothing like it. And to be frank, there still isn't that much like it. But I think it's still, as you say, the most powerful system out there, because it goes straight to the heart of the relationship we build with people. And it's incredibly practical. So on one level, it seems to do this intangible thing, which is, what are people thinking? But actually, it's an extremely practical system of experience design and content design and marketing communication design. And the whole thing works together very powerfully. So lots of organizations have transformed their audiences using it.
Well, it's great to have a segmentation product that is specifically designed for the culture sector. There are other segmentation products out there. You know, people might have heard of mosaic segments or helix personas, those kinds of things, which are generic across industries. But culture segments are specifically about people's kind of cultural motivations and the cultural venues and events that they attend. So can you give us a little bit of a flavour and talk about one or two segments just to bring this up to life for us?
Sure. Well, I will say that most creatives who we work with in the sector, so I'm thinking artistic directors and, you know, curators in museums and so on, tend to be in the essence segment. The essence segment, we often describe them as in pursuit of self-actualization. For them, culture and arts isn't something they do, it's who they are. It's like oxygen to them. They couldn't imagine life without it. It's why they call it essence, because it's literally their art's essential. They're discerning, knowledgeable, confident, experienced, but above all, they're independent, painfully independent. So they don't like following the crowd. They don't like being told what they will like and why they'll like it. They'll be the judge of that. Almost to the point where they may actually enjoy not liking things that everyone else likes, and maybe liking things that no one else likes. I do suspect sometimes that if they see a bad review, it makes them more likely to go, on the grounds that, you know, I'll be the judge of whether it's any good or not. And so they are by far and away, in almost every genre and art form, the most valuable segment. They're high value, but they're also incredibly high maintenance. So that's kind of interesting. And often when we have skeptical artistic leaders saying, oh, segmentation and all this marketing, when they see that segment, you know, it's almost apocryphal now that they say, this is the first segmentation system I've seen where I can see myself. This is the bit that acknowledges me. The other segment that a lot of creatives find themselves in is the segment I'm in, which is stimulation. And stimulation, it's all about ideas. It's like we love big ideas. We love the sweep of ideas. We like it when you connect something from 200 years ago with now or the future, or we get an artist to take a totally left field view of something, or it's socially engaged, or it's, you know, and so we like this dealing in big concepts. But we also like it when you mix art forms. We like it when you break rules. So we want whatever it is you're doing, we hope it's on the roof at midnight with fireworks and you know, I don't know, Aboriginal music. You know, so
and because only five people are invited.
Well, we don't care if there are more invited, but we want to be one of the first five. You know, so, and really what we wanted you to do is leak it to us in advance, and then we'll tell the whole of Melbourne. You know, it's about seeking out adventure, experiment, things that are really unusual, and bringing others to it. When we experience it, though, we do it almost entirely socially. So we drag other people along to something strange with a beer in our hand, and then sometimes it's amazing. So the creatives that are in that segment tend to work in design. They tend to work in kind of very visual things, a lot of kind of production kind of things like festivals and outdoor things and music things. So they're kind of two quite creative segments, but for a bit of contrast, expression are one of the biggest segments, and they are people. They're community-minded and communally-minded. Without them, we would really struggle, because they are hardwired to support cultural organizations. They think that culture is what makes society civilized. They are also incredibly egalitarian. They want everyone to have access to culture. They love organizations that reach out and try and diversify their audiences. In fact, they might well put their hand in their pocket to help them. We've just been playing with some pay it forward ticketing schemes. Nearly all the pay it forward donors are in the expression segment, because they want someone else to have this, you know, opportunity. And they call expression because they like to express themselves through culture, and they like to have a go. They also bring other people, and they're the people who go on Facebook and say, this is an incredible thing on. I'm thinking of getting tickets. Who wants to come? So they're very good at that. And then, you know, give you the final, I mean, there are eight, but I'll give you the final one for a bit more contrast, is something like affirmation. I love affirmation because they have decided as adults that culture is good for you and will make their lives better. And so there's a whiff of self-improvement about it. You know, it's a bit like joining a book group. It's a bit kind of the more books I read, or the more exhibitions I go to, or the more plays I attend, the more cultural I will be, the more I'll know. And also it feels like it's time well spent, it's worthwhile, you know. So they are constantly looking for things to do, and they're putting us on their list of things to do all of the time. The problem is, they need a huge amount of reassurance. So they need a lot of guarantees. They need a lot of recommendations. So they're poring over TripAdvisor and anywhere they can get their hands on, any word of mouth, any kind of recommendation they can get. I will tell you, my wife's in that segment. We've never had a bad restaurant meal because she's read every single review that anyone's ever written about everywhere. So literally, we only ever go to places that are incredibly well recommended. And it's the same with arts and culture, but it's surprising if you start to scrutinize our websites, our print, through the eyes of affirmation. They just see 20 reasons not to come, possibly because of what we've written, but mostly because of what we've not written. So we make the assumption that everyone knows what we do and they're all confident, they know where it is and it's or whatever. And they really want every step of the way laid out on a plate for them. They want it to be totally guaranteed. And if you can do that, we've seen contemporary dance companies and so on massively increase their audiences just by explaining the process of visiting to people and giving them a preview and giving them some kind of confidence. Whereas, you know, Essence, what that I started with, don't need any of that. It's like, just tell them the name, boom, they're in. You know, and there are four more. I should say also that although there are eight segments, it's not like a horoscope. It's not kind of, they're not two-dimensional. You know, we're not saying that there are only eight types of people in the world. They are nuanced and they are granular and they are whatever. And whilst these are incredibly deep-rooted, there are lots of people who are between the segments. They're more essence than they are stimulation, but they are not wholly one or the other. We allocate those people to the nearest one. And if they change their answers to the little which segment are you quiz you referred to earlier, sometimes they move across the boundary and we don't care. In fact, the messiness of that seems to us to be a validation of the fact that it's we're dealing with real people and real things. What's the lovely phrase? All models are wrong. Some of them are useful. I think this is a very useful model.
Well, I think it is too. I mean, I was just refreshing myself on it yesterday, actually. And, you know, a few things go through my mind. One is that, you know, you can always read about a segment and think of someone you know who is that segment, can't you? And it's funny, a lot of what we hear in focus groups, things people say very much, you can almost identify what segment they're from based on what they say. So if they're like, oh, I want to, you know, broaden my horizons kind of thing, you can imagine what segment they fit in. But I was also playing around with the tool, and I think in the past I've identified most with the stimulation segment. I'm like you're like that sort of ideas stuff. But I think these days with two young kids, I think I'm more release now. Is that possible to change?
Absolutely. And release is the odd one out of the eight segments. It's kind of, if you've played Monopoly, it's like just visiting the jail. It's where you go when life overtakes you. So most people in release say, I used to be really culturally active, but yeah, a kid and a mortgage and a job. And yeah. And so so release is really just time poor. And it's kind of inside there. There's somebody who'd love to do more. I mean, you work in the sector, so it's slightly different. But what's interesting is release a kind of, if I only do one cultural thing this month, what should it be? And it has to be almost nailed on. It's kind of like, even though you might have, you know, previously taken all kinds of risks, it's like you're not going to take a risk with your one and only visit. So you want to go
this
to the thing that you know is really good. That doesn't mean it has to be kind of traditional or safe. It could be contemporary and whatever, but you need somebody to have told you this is definitely worth it. You're going to love this. And release, therefore, you remember I mentioned affirmation needed a lot of reassurance. In some ways, release and affirmation when you're marketing to them need the same. They basically need you to tell them, go to this. This is going to definitely deliver for you this, because it's like this and this and this. And so it's, yeah, you can change. It's funny. If I change all of the answers, I stay in stimulation. Robin, who actually designed the algorithm, if he changes one of his answers, he moves into the next segment. I'm entirely relaxed by that. I will also tell you one thing, and you know, listeners might like this, is that I have a party trick, which is people, when I go and do talks and things, people say to me, well, I was in the such and such, I was in one segment and I've done it again and now I'm in a different segment. And partly from the way they say it, I say, were you in Essence the first time? They go, yes, how do you know? And the reason is Essence's independence and not wanting to follow the crowd means that Essence is the one segment that hates being segmented. They hate the idea that somebody could actually say, yes, you and all the other people like you are in this group. So I did have a museum director once berate me for 15 minutes on how it's not possible to understand all of this about somebody from just so few questions, and how this is so reductive, and how it's, you know, it's pigeonholing people and so on, and blah, blah, blah. And then when she kind of ran out of steam, she said, but that's probably just because I'm essence. So I said, rest my case.
Fair enough. So, I think segmentation is such an interesting tool for everyone except essence, but it's not always easy to apply, is it? So sometimes I think it's, you know, it's easy to think, oh, that's really interesting, but when it gets to practically kind of implementing it, it's not always kind of straightforward. So I was just going to ask you, and we've sort of glossed over kind of exactly how it works, but just to peek under the hood, it's driven by answers to survey questions, isn't it? And then there's an algorithm that, based on your answers, will sort you into a segment.
It was originated on an enormous survey and a huge number of questions. And the algorithm itself was devised using 37 different questions. But obviously that's impractical. So, you know, we'd given ourselves 6 months to produce this, and it took more like 18 months. And then it took another 6 months to get it from 37 questions down to, it takes just over a minute to segment yourself using this quiz. It's very few statements. But that puts you in the right segment, as in the same as if you'd done all 37 questions nearly all of the time. So it's very accurate. There are now about 1.5 million people who've taken this, and the algorithm is therefore based on 1.5 million answers. So it's powerful. The thing is, Culture Segments has kind of two lives. It has a life just as Insight. You don't have to do anything technical. No money has to change hands. You can literally just go on our website, download it, and look at it, read it. And there are also case studies and all kinds of things. And just the Insight itself is powerful. And one of the things I would say, that the segments don't read very technically. They read like people you know. Now, as you were saying, oh, well, somebody says that to you, I think, ah. Oh. We have trained front of house staff in museums. Just in the first 20 seconds of talking to a visitor, they can pretty much peg which segment they're in. And then they kind of advise them from there. You know, nobody's taken any tests. It's just done on human intuition. If people are listening to this and they're thinking, how could I use this? If you think of your program, whatever you do, you've got plays or you've got exhibitions or you've got events or whatever you've got, gigs, anything, you could look across your entire program and look at the 8 segments, and you could start to say, oh, well, that concert or that play or that event, that's brilliant for stimulation. They'd love that because it's on the roof at midnight with the fireworks. This one is quite traditional, it's quite formal, it's quite... So the enrichment segment, who are kind of a bit more traditional, a bit more studied, that might be their thing. And you could easily go through, and this one's like kind of everyone together, and it's participation, so expression are going to love that, absolutely love that. And this one is like a, you know, contemporary artist who's... practice is really well. So essence are going to love that because it's really kind of pushing the envelope of art practice. So you can go through your program, and even if you know, if you're a symphony orchestra, you can go through and say, these people are going to like the Mozart concert, this Shostakovich is probably going to be more these people. And so you can quickly work out what you have, like who is the primary segment for each of your activities, and maybe who's the secondary segment for each one of your activities. Of course, you can read that the other way. You can say, right, so what are we offering stimulation? It's that and that. What are we offering expression? Nothing. You know. And so that's okay if you're not targeting expression, but you can quickly work out your footprint. We've got lots of people who've done that, festivals, all kinds of people, and then subsequently have done a survey that collected the segment data, and I'm going to say they were 85% correct. Just rule of thumb, just by eye, they can get, you know, 85% accuracy on which segments would like what. And there'll be a few surprises. And so knowing that, you can either just understand it and then use that for marketing, but you can also use it for programming. So you can start to say, oh, we've got 3 things on for expression this year. Unfortunately, they're all within a fortnight of each other. And then we've got nothing for 11 months. So, you know, maybe it's to do with when you put things on and so on. And so you literally, that's free. There's case studies of how other people have used it, and there's loads of ideas in there. There's also a lot of information about things like copywriting, you know, the phrases and words that you might put in emails and subject lines that will massively increase your open rates and your click-through rates, or the opposite, depending on which segment you're aiming at. So even if you don't know the segment of the people you're aiming at, it doesn't stop you writing the copy and crafting the things to be for the segment you think ought to be coming to this event. So you can use this with no data, that's what I'm saying, and it will be of benefit to you. But its second life is data-driven. Proof of concept, if you like. But if you want to do this, it's then relatively straightforward to add this to anything. You can add it to a survey, and all the results in your survey are now available by segment. We have a tagging tool, and it works with all kinds of, you know, box office systems, from Tessitura to Patreon-based to all kinds of things, where you can add this to the end of the booking path. You can email it to people, and they will answer the questions, take them a minute online, and when they press submit, it can automatically write the results back to your database. You don't have to do anything. So the next time you open your database, lots of people will be tagged. So if you imagine you get to the point where lots of records on your database are tagged, and you, we mentioned stimulation earlier, we want to be the first five. If you've got an event, the life cycle of your event, you need to tell Essence, the real culture vultures, and Stimulation, who can't keep their mouth shut about it, early. Because they're the people who are willing to take the risk on booking. They're the people who are going to tell everyone else about it. They're the people who are going to give your show credibility. If you know who's Stimulation on your database, and you give us the heads up, and you give us the exclusive inside line, we will literally tell everyone. We'll tell everyone. Nothing ever went viral on social media unless Stimulation get behind it. Stimulation are make or break for anything going viral, literally.
Yeah, I love the power of it. And I think for the data-driven side of it, I think that's really important for large organizations with very large databases who don't want to be promoting everything to everyone all of the time. So I think the larger you are, the more discerning and careful you need to be with something like email marketing, because we know that everyone's fatigued, everyone's got inbox overload. So you want the email that you send to your most precious and valued audiences to be the right one, don't you? So I think for those very large organizations, it's a powerful tool to help say, we're going to send the right offers to the right people at the right time and not overload.
There's one more thing about that, though, which is at the moment, because we can't send everything to everyone, we tend to do it on behavior. If you previously booked for Shakespeare, we'll give you Shakespeare. But a lot of the research says your response rates to that are like 5%. And when you ask why, which nobody really ever does, but we do, they say, well, I've just been to a Shakespeare. We're sending it to you because you've just been to a Shakespeare. And they're saying, I'm not coming because I've just been to a Shakespeare. I'd now like contemporary dance. And what this does is it prospects for new people in your database who have no history of seeing this, on the basis that they are in the same segment as the people who really like this. And so if people in the same segment love this, then they're likely to be the next people to come. So most orthodox arts marketing targets the people who've already been, but using culture segments, it can target the people who should be coming.
Great. So I want to talk about how this kind of tool can be useful during COVID. One of the articles you wrote as a part of your Culture in Lockdown series was about COVID audience mindsets. And at the start of that article, you said something quite powerful and a little bit provocative, actually, which is this. You wrote, "Here's the painful truth. Not all our organizations are going to make it through this crisis. But those whose plans are most audience focused will have a huge advantage over those whose focus is mainly on adapted presenting formats and the logistics of safety." Tell us a little bit about audience focus and how the COVID audience mindsets can help organizations to, I guess, adjust and adapt to this new world order.
We were really interested in how we could best support organizations through the crisis. You know, you remember the first act, which was everybody put everything online. We just spammed the internet with every single piece of culture we had, and we just digitized it and bashed it online. Kind of overload. Amazing, like, logistical feat, but questionable who was actually engaging with what. And we became interested in how people were using that digital work and whether it would have any long-term effect. Lots of people were saying, this has changed forever. The genie's out of the bottle. It can never go back. It'll all, you know. And what we found was that each of the segments was using digital and was behaving during COVID in very different ways. And their intention to return and their attitudes towards safety on return were wildly different to each other. So I'll give you an example. Essence, who we talked about earlier, the most discerning, frequent group, they were the number one users, bar none, of digital art. They devoured it online. They just were, because remember, I say it's like oxygen to them, they need it. So if fresh air isn't available, they'll take the bottled kind. So they were just, gorging on the internet. Something like Expression, the people, the community people, they used some, not as much, maybe less than half of what Essence were using. But if you ask the question, what's this like? How do you like it? What are you getting from this experience? Essence, not that impressed, because they like the real thing. For Essence, they need to be in the room with the artist doing the thing. It's like visceral to them. So they'll take digital as a kind of poor substitution rather than have nothing. But doesn't mean that they love digital. They're tolerating digital. So the number one users of digital are kind of meh. They're just tolerating it until they can see the real thing. They can kind of see that if we had the right content that was like background information, depth interviews with artists, that could enhance the experience, but it'll never, ever replace it. It's never an alternative. Whereas Expression are just so impressed and so pleased that we're doing all of this stuff online. And they're also saying, isn't this great that all these people who previously didn't have access to it can now see it all online and it's free, So they're not using it as much, but they are just in love with everything we're doing. It's like the best thing we've ever seen. And I remember I mentioned Affirmation, who needed a lot of reassurance and whatever. They are using this like a test drive. They're using it to try before you buy. They, from the safety of their own sofa, they can now road test all of these things that they weren't quite sure about going to, but they can now literally have a taster of it. And they go, well, we could go there. That looks actually quite good. I've seen a play now from that theater, and it's just the kind of thing we would like. We should go there when it all reopens. So people are using this in such different ways. And there are some segments that are so nervous about returning. And obviously, that's going to be more so in the States and more so in some of Europe than it maybe is in Australia and New Zealand, although you're having your moments. But there are real differences in how people will return, why they will return, and how they're behaving with digital now, and how they might use digital in the future. All that's published, by the way. I'm sure you could put the link to that article, but there's a Medium article called COVID Audience Mindsets, which is, it's all in there.
Great. I'll link to that in the show notes.
Use it to plan, because it's got a lot of information about how people will respond. And, it's based on a lot of research.
Fantastic. Well, one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking about some of the examples of how this could be used in programming or in marketing or for copywriting or for front of house staff who are liaising directly with visitors or audience members is that it's a nice exercise to bring a whole organization or a whole team together, isn't it? And to dive into it, the insight, even if you don't know quantitatively what proportion of which segments in your audience, you can still use the segments, as you said, to generate ideas and workshop as a team how different segments might be responding to, your work during the pandemic and what you need to do to help them one day, when the time's right, come back. So I think it's a really nice exercise for like a strategic planning session internally or something like that.
We keep having lots of things either in real life where people have got their a sticker on with their culture segment on, or in Zoom we have people with their name and then their culture segment. But it's quite nice because people say, oh, you are so stimulation. It's like, that's perfect for you. But it's also interesting, I found, like, you know, we work with organizations where they've realized that their entire marketing department is stimulation, and no wonder they struggle to write for expression, because, you know, they write copy that they think's amazing and expression don't. So learning to write for different culture segments, learning to understand, is quite good. And if you know who else in your organization is in the other segment, you can go read this. And I still have colleagues who send me things saying, your stimulation, read that.
So I will also mention that for organizations based in Victoria, there's Creative Victoria's Audience Atlas. Will you just tell us a little bit about what that project offers for people?
This is spectacular. It's like, you know, we've done these all over the world, but Victoria is the world's leading destination for culture segments, Audience Atlas. So Audience Atlas is a kind of giant population survey that delves really deeply into people's cultural lives. But rather than just do that generically, it names not only every art form and every participation activity that you could think of, it actually names a huge number of individual venues and arts organizations and companies. And it finds out whether people have ever heard of these places and people, whether they've ever been to them, whether they've been recently, whether they would consider going in the future. The whole thing, obviously by all the usual demographics, but also by culture segments. And so individual organizations can actually find out the size of their, you know, the market, who's aware of them, who's been, what their potential audience is by culture segment. And so literally they can map that. It's all that data is free. It's all, you can access it all through the Creative Victoria website. And I have to say, this is the second time that Creative Victoria have invested in this, and it is the most comprehensive set of data for anywhere in the world. So Creative Victoria really, you know, we should take our hats off to them, because they really have put them, you know, money into this, and it's fantastic. So organizations across Victoria just can have the benefit of all of that data on their market and real detail for nothing. Then the other thing I was going to say, and we extended this to organizations in Victoria, but to be honest, I'd extend it to any of your listeners, wherever they are in the world, is that, you know, I'm happy to give anyone an hour. You know, if people want to ask questions or try and work out how they might use this stuff, even just all the free stuff, you know, really not a sales pitch, just if you're interested in this stuff and you want to get to grips with it and you want a bit of advice, I'm more than happy to do that. And during COVID, you know, I must have done that, you know, for maybe over 50 organizations, just had, you know, just a chat. Where we've just been helping them to see how they can make best use of this stuff. And I just want people to use it. So
that is incredibly generous. There you go, folks. Jump on that.
I'm MHM Andrew on Twitter. And I think I'm Andrew.McIntyre. I know at MHMinsight.com.
Well, I'll pop some links in the show notes for people to find out more about you, MHM, and the culture segments work. So can I ask, to wrap up our conversation, if there was one idea that culture professionals could embrace for real change and renewal in our sector, what would it be?
Most of my practice is about organizational change. It's through the lens of audience focus, through engaging with audiences. And what I would say is, you know, although COVID has been the most, you know, devastating experience for all of us, if I'm being really super honest with you, the space that organizations had pre-COVID to engage in that kind of change, unless they were kind of in crisis of some kind, was tiny. I think the business as usual, you know, the tyranny of business plans and forward plans and budgets and whatever, mean that 95% of organizations' activity is already predetermined. So if you go in trying to change something, you're working in this claustrophobic little 5% that's left in the corner to try things. In COVID, it's been the other way around. It's only 5% business as usual. We've got 95%. What on earth should we do? And that's a kind of vast liminal space in which anything's possible. And we've really been saying to organizations is, what's possible is reimagining your organization in an audience-focused way. And so audience focus and audience engagement is usually seen as a kind of objective in your plan somewhere. It might even be a subset of your marketing plan. If I had one big idea, it's this. It's that audience engagement is not a marketing objective. It's a fundamental strategy for the whole organization. And it's not just a strategy, it's actually a methodology. There is a whole way of taking the whole organization through the process of everyone being responsible for engaging with the audience. We design audience engagement in every single department function from the beginning. And when I've not been doing my 50 organizations bit of free advice, I've been working with a number of organizations, large and small, on root and branch change in their organizations using audience focus and audience insight. And I'm just so excited to see what those organizations are going to do as they get into their stride or when they return. Some of them are already returned because they always had passion, but now they've articulated the methodology to convert that into audience engagement. And so in an odd way, although there are some organizations that have been devastated by this, I kind of think some organizations are going to come out of this having used the time well. And there's still time for people to embark on that now, but to really use this to rethink the fundamental relationship we have with audiences. And those organizations that have built audience engagement are the ones that are the most resilient. They have the deepest roots. The ones that didn't do that are the ones that are really suffering. So my plea would be, now is the time to have a real rethink.
Never waste a crisis, as the saying goes. All right. Thank you so much, Andrew. That's been a wonderful conversation diving into culture segments. So for those listening, I'll pop a bunch of links in the show notes, and please get in touch with Andrew if you want to find out more or get advice for your particular situation. Thank you, Andrew.
And I should say, by the way, we've also got staff in Melbourne, in Australia, and in Auckland, in New Zealand, and now in New York as well. So my colleagues would probably offer the same.
Yes, you've got some wonderful colleagues in this part of the world. So a great team. Thanks again for a great conversation, Andrew.
Thanks, Tandy.
So there you have it, a closer look at segmentation and how an understanding of culture mindsets can help us navigate these times and connect with audiences more deeply in future. So my top takeaways from the discussion are, number one, that different people have very different motivations for engaging in cultural experiences. And along with demographics, it's their beliefs and values that dictate what experiences people seek out. Number two, that if we can be conscious of how that thinking works, we can create experiences and design marketing campaigns that resonate more deeply. Number three, that a knowledge of culture segments is powerful, even if you don't actually quantify the segments in your particular audience through surveying. A knowledge of the segments alone can be helpful, and it can be helpful for programming, marketing, front of house or visitor information. And it's actually a great resource or foundation exercise for a strategic planning day with the whole team. Number five, for organizations with very large databases, targeted marketing campaigns that are targeted to segments can actually supplement or provide an alternative to marketing based solely on past participation with your organization. Number six, that by becoming more attuned to audience mindsets and values, we can more quickly satisfy their needs because we understand what is going on beneath the surface of what they say or do. And lastly, that audience engagement is usually seen kind of as an objective within a strategic plan or even within a marketing plan, but it can be a fundamental strategy for a whole organization and that one which everyone is responsible for. As always, head to the show notes for links on everything we've talked about. I've got a whole bunch of links from our conversation today, including a link to culture segments where you can take a quiz and find out what segment you are and some of the other things we talked about. Now, every month, my team compiles a Culture Insight and Innovation Update, which is an email newsletter with the latest research releases, big ideas and resources and toolkits from around the world. I thought what I would do in the podcast after my interviews is share the top most clicked item from the last newsletter and just talk a bit about why we think it's interesting so that you can be in the know. So this month, I have to cheat a little bit because the most clicked item in our last newsletter was actually our own research. We released the March 2021 results of the Audience Outlook Monitor, and it shows that audiences are flooding back to events in Australia. Audiences feel particularly comfortable at outdoor venues, and so we're seeing a resurgence in confidence over summer with all the outdoor programming. So as winter approaches, here in Australia, we're going to have to be a bit more vigilant about social distancing, as people are likely to be a bit more sensitive about indoor venues. And the challenge for our sector in the coming months is to try and balance the needs of those who are super relaxed and probably don't even notice that they are edging right up beside a stranger in the gallery, and really balance those people with the audiences that are a bit more cautious right now and feel horrified when someone stands close to them in the gallery. So enough of our own research. The second most clicked item, which I will go to this month since that was a cheat, was an article about NFTs. Now, NFTs, non-fungible tokens, are taking the world by storm at the moment after artists and creators started selling authentic digital items like video clips and image files for literally millions of dollars. Now, I'm talking kind of extraordinary amounts that are being exchanged through the blockchain. Now, depending on who you ask, it's either an ecologically destructive speculative bubble or a promising new funding model for arts and culture. And this article has everything you need to know about how NFTs work and where this could be heading. So if you want to get the full story, I'll pop a link to those items in the show notes. And if you want to subscribe for the newsletter each month, you can also click through to that. That's it from me for now. I will see you next month. If you heard something that you want to know a little bit more about, you can visit the show notes. These are a set of resources that my team compile on every episode, including the guest bios, key points covered, and useful links to resources mentioned in the conversation. You can access these at our website, www.thepatternmakers.com.au/theory of creativity, one word. Now, if you've made it to this point, then I have a favour to ask. Will you take 30 seconds to rate and review Theory of Creativity? And if you hit subscribe, you'll be helping more people hear these ideas, techniques, and tools so that collectively we can do even more good in the world. Sound like a plan? This project has been assisted by the Australian Government through the Australia Council, its arts funding and advisory body. It has been produced in collaboration with arts leaders around Australia. You know who you are. Thank you so much for your support. We'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners upon whose lands this podcast is made, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And we want to acknowledge First Nations people everywhere.